Radio Drone. Welcome to another Radio Drone special. This time, I'm going to be giving you guys the interview that I did with Peter David. Peter David's a name you might not know unless you're a big comic book fan. You'd know him from The Incredible Hulk, from Dreadstar, from any number of comic books. He's a fantastic writer. He's also written Star Trek novels, Star Wars novels. He's written episodes of TV series. He wrote Trancers 4 and 5, as well as Oblivion 1 and 2 for Full Moon. Peter David is a fantastic writer. I talked to him a little bit about working with licensed properties and some of his writing style, which I think if you guys do not read Peter David, you need to. I also recommend picking up his book, But I Digress, as well as its sequel, which collect some of the best of his columns from Comic Buyer's Guide. Here is Peter David.
You've had a career that expands since the first thing I remember reading from you was in the 80s. Do you look back at your early work and kind of go, wow, what was I thinking? Or, damn, I was dead on right then, too.
Oh, no. I look up on my early stuff and all I can see are the flaws. But then again, I look at most of my stuff and all I can see are the flaws. I have very little work that I would look back on and say, wow, I got that absolutely right. So, yeah, I tend to look at the early 80s stuff and all I can see is the stuff that I would never do now.
When you do that, do you kind of wish that, because we're going to get into some of your lost works in a moment, do you kind of wish that some of those were lost works? I like seeing the progression of a writer. And
right.
I'll say, even when I see your really early stuff, it feels like Peter David, even if it's early Peter David.
No, I don't wish that anything would go away. I mean, I'm proud of everything that I've done. You know, there's stuff that I feel that I could do much better now. I indeed had that opportunity. For example, when Nightlife was republished by Ace Books, we were originally just going to republish the original novel. And I was going to go through it and make some adjustments to make it more modern day. And by that, I figured what I would do is, you know, for example, substitute computers every place. I had people doing typewriters, that kind of thing. But as I read the manuscript, as I read the original manuscript, I was struck by all the things that I felt where the book was coming up short, and a place where I did shortcuts because I didn't know how to do it right. So I wound up doing a heavy rewrite on the manuscript to such a degree that the original manuscript was 65,000 words and the rewritten one was 95,000 words. So I wound up resulting in two more books because I came up with so much additional material to put in. So it's, writing is a continuing learning process. If you look at stuff that you did 20, 30 years ago and you're completely satisfied with it, chances are there's something wrong with the writing or wrong with you.
Now, my favorite run of yours, I know everyone's going to say the Hulk, and I don't disagree that your Hulk run is a great run. I got to go with the run you did on Dreadstar. I think I absolutely loved it. And you had a perfect example of the kind of humor that I thought you injected into Dreadstar was what was basically a throwaway joke that I thought was so brilliant. Two aliens were like looking at a planet or something, and they said, it's like 9,000 gleeble globs away. And then that little asterisk said, that's like 14,000 bleens.
Yes.
And I thought that joke was brilliant that you translated gobbledygook into other gobbledygook.
Other gobbledygook. Well, that's because it has become such a trope in comic books that they would come up with these fictional units of measurement and then have little captions that indicated what it corresponded to in human measurement. And I always thought that was such a complete waste of time. I mean, who do you think you're fooling here? You know? So I thought it would be funny to have a unit of measurement and have it transcribed to another unit of alien measurement, so you still would actually have no freaking clue how far it was. I remember doing that. That was fun.
I just thought that was, and it was such a like a throwaway gag that I thought perfectly exemplified the new style, because your Dreadstar run, at least to me, was so different than the Luke McDonald and Jim Starlin stuff that had come before it. Was that a specific conscious choice that you wanted to make it lighter and more fun, or how did that happen? And did you get in any kind of interference from Jim Starlin since they were his?
No interference whatsoever. Jim gave me total carte blanche to do whatever I wanted. I, to this day, have no idea why in God's name Jim thought that I would be a good person to follow him on Dreadstar, because my writing style is 180 degrees from Jim's. And I really have no idea, unless he just wanted someone to take it in a wildly different direction. And he said to me, I want you to come on this book and write whatever you want to write. And he insisted on, I think like once or twice he asked about stuff that I was planning, mostly because he was just curious as to where I was going. Not because he was planning to countermand me or anything, but he was just curious to know what I was doing. And loved it every time that I told him. But yeah, Jim could not have been more supportive.
The one thing that I get from people when I see them re-going over these is just how much of a stark difference it is almost right off the bat. Because the Luke McDonnell era, I enjoyed it. I'm not complaining about it. But it was dark. It was heavy. And then your stuff was much lighter and fun. You didn't really make a big transition period. You just kind of like, yeah, all that dark, heavy stuff is over. Did fans react well to that? Because I admit, I didn't read these when they were new. I got all these after the fact. So I don't know what the reaction was when these were first coming out.
I honestly, God, don't remember. I hope they did. But, you know, this was like 30 years ago. I barely remember stuff I wrote 30 years ago, much less what somebody wrote about what I wrote 30 years ago. Plus, it was really before the prevalence of the internet, where you can find out what everybody's thinking within minutes of the book coming out. I honestly don't remember any fan letters. First got them, I don't think they sent them to me. So I have no idea what the fan reaction was. I hope they liked it.
And then let's use Dreadstar to move into the Lost Works. Now, when Dreadstar was canceled, first kind of went under relatively quickly. There was the 1994 miniseries, which I enjoyed quite a bit. Planet Skeevo was just awesome. But
thank you.
I see on your webpage you have a Lost Work of the Fall series. Is that essentially what we got in 1994, or was it something totally different?
The Fall? I have no idea what that is.
It's listed on your webpage as a Lost Dreadstar story.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Maybe it was the very last story that I was planning to do, but I don't think that was going to be a limited series or anything.
PeterDavid.net, Dreadstar The Fall. This would have been a 3-issue miniseries continuing the Dreadstar storyline from the monthly series. First Comics went out of business before the miniseries could be published. It is unknown how much of the art was completed.
To the best of my knowledge, none of the art was completed. I don't even remember writing it.
I'm just going off your webpage because I didn't know about that
one. I believe you. I have no recollection of the Fall. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, and then that brings us into, you've got a lot of lost or unpublished works. Does it kind of bother you that you work so hard on these things? I mean, I know you get paid for it regardless, but that the audience is never going to be able to see, like, the Nightmare on Elm Street stories you wrote or anything like that?
Well, it's a little frustrating, but I really don't have any place to be upset about it because there's lots of people out there who work just as hard on stuff, and none of their stuff gets out. I mean, there are people who work on screenplays, dozens and dozens, dozens, hundreds, thousands of screenplays that people work on and nobody ever sees the screenplays. People work on novels and the novels never get published. I mean, at least I'm fortunate enough to be able to get my work out there. I don't see how I really have the right to be bitchy or cranky because some of my work didn't get out to the audience. I mean, do I regret that some of the stuff didn't get out there? Yeah, I'm frustrated that nobody will ever see the Nightmare on Elm Street stories because I thought they were perfectly fine and perfectly entertaining. It's probably my greatest frustration, the thing that didn't see print that still bugs me to this day, was my Star Wars script. I loved my Star Wars script. Dark Horse commissioned me to do a 4-issue series called Star Wars Splinters, and essentially alternate reality versions of Star Wars. The challenge was to take a moment in Star Wars and have it zig instead of zag and see how it all came out. And I chose what to my mind was one of the major moments in Star Wars, a moment that I actually immortalized in a short piece called Skippy the Jedi Droid, in which the R5-D4 unit winds up malfunctioning. And I came up with a story in which the R5-D4 unit did not, in fact, malfunction. And I followed the story from there. And the way that the story wound up going, it ended with Princess Leia was now a Sith Lord and ruling the Empire with an iron fist aided by her young student and consort, Luke Skywalker. And this is going to be a completely demented story, which it has to be if you're going to end it with Luke and Leia as lovers. And I just loved it, and Dark Horse loved it, and we sent it to Lucasfilm, and Lucasfilm had said that they were perfectly okay with this whole storyline. And then they read it, and they came back, and they said, no, you can't do this. It has to end with Luke and Leia saving the day and the Empire being destroyed. And we said, well, that's the end of Star Wars. They said, yes, it has to end like the end of Star Wars. You can't go off in a totally different direction, which frustrated me because, you know, and I said, well, then I'm out because that's not what I wanted to write. And it frustrates me to this day. I mean, the original story was going to be so cool. The cover for issue 3 was going to be Leia with the Darth Maul facial makeup. You know, it was just going to be so freaking cool. We didn't get to do it. And if I had to pick one story of mine that I get frustrated about never having had a chance to see to get to the audience, it would be that one.
Well, do you ever think with the considerable clout that you do have, do you ever try and buy the rights to maybe these stories and publish them yourself? Like, maybe
I buy the rights to Star Wars, you know.
Well, I don't mean Star Wars. I mean, like, maybe the Freddy Kruegers or maybe even make a deal with Marvel or something like that, or whoever happens to own Freddy Krueger, to just print these as a special thing. Because I think, honestly, the lost works of Peter David would probably sell quite well.
Well, if you say so, I don't know if people would be that interested.
I think you're underestimating the influence you have and had on the industry.
Okay, well, we'll have to agree to disagree on that one, but okay.
Well, and then that also brings up, I guess, what my next question would be. Since you work with a lot of licensed properties, do you get that kind of interference regularly, or do you normally have free rein to do whatever you want with X-Factor, the Hulk, Disney, any of the DC characters, or any of the cartoons?
It depends on the licensor. It depends on the property. There are some properties that I have total freedom to do whatever the hell I want. There are other properties where the overseeing of it is extremely stringent and can be an extreme pain in the ass. It really depends upon the respective situation. It even depends upon the people involved. I mean, once upon a time, writing Star Trek was an incredible pain in the ass because of one guy who shall go nameless, Richard Arnold was his name, who worked for Gene Roddenberry, and he made everybody's lives working for Star Trek absolutely miserable. And then he was fired, and suddenly it was much easier to write Star Trek novels. So you see, it really depends upon the people involved.
Well, and then that also, I guess, brings up then, look at, you know, you did those movies for Charles Band, Tranchers 4 and 5 and Oblivion 1 and 2, which, by the way, I think the Oblivion films are incredibly underrated. That's the real Cowboys and Aliens, if you ask me.
Yeah, when they announced Cowboys and Aliens, I'm going, I did that 10 years ago, didn't I?
Charles Band actually re-released the movie with a very Cowboys and Aliens-esque cover for the Oblivion DVDs, which I thought was kind of shameless, but for Charles Band, kind of right up his alley, too.
Yeah, really.
No, did you have a good experience on those? Because I noticed you only worked on those four, and that was it, really.
Right.
Is there a reason
didn't do more? After that, I wound up joining the WGA and then could no longer work for Charlie because he only hired people who were not WGA members.
What did you think about how the movies turned out, all the four of them, the two Oblivions and the two Trancers?
I loved the Oblivion films. I was frustrated by the Trancer movies because Charlie told me to just, you know, have a totally unbridled imagination, just write whatever I wanted to write. He didn't really tell me that we had no budget. I mean, you're thinking a budget of like $1.98. It was frustrating because I wrote these big, sprawling, adventurous epics. And Dave Nutter, who was the director, did the best he could with resources that he had. But there were scenes that were incredibly winnowed down. I mean, the example that I've used to describe it is the following. You know the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark? He goes into the cavern and he grabs the thing and things start shaking and the darts go flying and the rock follows him and he's in the lake and all that stuff. You know that, right?
Yes.
I said, if that were a full moon picture, I want you to envision that you have no money for sets, no money for stuntmen, no money for special effects, no money for extras. The beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark, if it had been filmed by full moon, would have been as follows. Indiana Jones, by himself, in a jungle, creeps up to an outdoor podium on which the thing is set. He creeps up to it, switches it out. The camera starts to shake. Indy looks around and runs. The end. That's the opening of Raiders. You see the problem. It was the same problem in writing Transformers 4 and 5. I wrote these big, brawling, adventurous epics, and maybe a fifth of what I wrote actually got onto screen. That's why the second one was like 65 minutes. They cut all my big adventure stuff, and that was tremendously frustrating. I mean, I will stand right by the screenplays that I wrote because I'm really proud of them. They were not accurately represented in the movie.
Reading in But I Digress that you really wanted Ron Perlman for the Caliban character, too.
Desperately. He auditioned. I was there for his audition. I chatted with him. He was really a cool guy. And his agent, wisely, in my opinion, said, you know, they negotiated for money and they couldn't come to terms on money, probably because Full Moon wasn't actually interested in paying any. And, you know who he had reading for that? Ron Perlman and French Stewart. He read for Caliban's henchmen. They were the guys I wanted. I wanted Ron Perlman for Caliban, French Stewart for Caliban's henchmen. And we got the guys we did, who I thought did a perfectly good job, but they didn't bring it to the level that a Ron Perlman and a French Stewart would have been able to bring it to.
Now, what is the difference between those two and the Oblivion movies, which seemed to have a lot of money, because those had such a huge cast, tons of costumes, effects. You got Andrew Divoff as Red Eye, Moonsta Vander, I'm sure I just butchered her name, as Lash. What was the difference between the Oblivions and the Transfer?
We had George Takei, baby. That was a great experience. They had money for those. I don't know where Charlie Band got the money for it, but the two Oblivion movies, which were filmed simultaneously, he actually had a few million dollars to spend. I don't know how he had a few million dollars to spend, but he did. You know, we had an actual Western set, which was kind of unusual. We had Julie Newmar, for God's sake. Carl Striken was wonderful. I mean, we had a terrific cast. And I don't know whether they just all agreed to work for next to nothing or whether he actually had money to pay these folks. But it was a hoot and a half. I mean, Oblivion was actually fulfills the storyline as I wrote it. I was kind of astounded. Nothing was cut from the two screenplays that I wrote. We were really astounded when he actually found the money to give us our effects with giant monsters at the end of the second movie. I mean, you know, we actually had giant monsters. I couldn't believe it.
Why did you then agree to work on the Oblivions after the experience on Trancers? I mean, even though it turned out in your favor, did you kind of feel that your Oblivion scripts might get gutted?
Because by the time I was working on Oblivion, I had not seen Trancers yet.
Oh, so you didn't know how
I was only in Romania for a week or two. I was totally unaware of how much had been cut.
Okay.
And how much had not been filmed.
Have you ever tried to make other movies with whether it's Charles Band or not? Because I see you've got a lot of scripts for TV. Like, I personally would have really liked to have seen your X-Files script, especially season one X-Files. I think that would have been really interesting.
That would have been cool, but it didn't go anywhere.
What do you think of when people look at your work from the newer stuff to the 90s stuff, when they look at your work and it always seems to have a lighter tone to it? And I'm not saying that in a derogatory way, but I mean, mm-hmm. like your Hulk run, you had characters killed. I mean, yeah, you had Marla killed by a female Norman Bates, basically.
Yes.
And yet it never felt heavy. It never felt dark. It always, maybe it was Dale Keown's artwork. The Hulk run got very dark. I mean, there was one point, I remember the Hulk had all the skin flayed off of his bones.
Oh, yeah.
And it never feels dark. Is that something you intend to do, or is that just your style?
I suppose it's my style. I mean, I tend to manage to see the levity in even the most dire situations. In all regards, I mean, when I had my stroke in Florida and they were taking me in an ambulance from one facility to the other, I was cracking jokes in the ambulance. At one point, the doctor told me that I'd had a cardiac episode, and I said, worst episode ever, you know. I just tend to find the humor in situations, even when the situation doesn't really seem to call for it, I guess.
Speaking of that, you had your stroke. You sound like you're very quite well recovered. Has that altered
how
you
write? I'm not talking on one side of my mouth, if that's what you mean.
Well, no, I mean, has it altered how you write? Because I remember when Frank Frazetta had his stroke, he had to teach himself to paint with his other hand.
No, I mean, for a while I couldn't type with any speed because my right hand was more or less dead. I have since managed to come back, and I can now type at a normal speed, so that's good. It took me a while to manage to recover my typing ability.
Well, and speaking of typing, one of the things I always loved was, but I digress. Honestly, that was the only reason I bought Comic Buyer's Guide by the mid-90s. Huh. Comic Buyer's Guide, to me, was you buy But I Digress, and there's other stuff in it, too. And I have the collections as well. Does it hurt you that But I Digress, at least in Comic Buyer's Guide, is no longer being published, or was it kind of a relief after that many years to not have that on your schedule as well?
I really thought that But I Digress would last a year or two. It never occurred to me that I would be writing it nonstop for 20 years. And the world has changed to such a degree that I think that was having less. I mean, it used to be that I would write something in But I Digress and it would have tremendous impact. And that really wasn't happening anymore. People seem to be paying like less and less attention to it, to the point where I was really wondering if there was any point in doing it anymore. And then the magazine folded, and that was pretty much that. I didn't even know it was going to be going away. I mean, I literally got a memo that said, "Hi, we just put out our last issue. It was nice working with you." And I'm going, "Huh?" You know, I had absolutely no warning at all.
Would have been nice if you got a final column or something.
Well, I did actually get a final column. I wrote it for the publication Alter Ego that just came out. So if you want to read my final But I Digress column, feel free to pick up Alter Ego. It's there.
Have you ever thought about doing a third reprint book volume?
Well, I was disappointed with the sales on the second reprint volume. I mean, it's really weird. People kept telling me they want to see a new But I Digress costume. They want to see it. They want to see it. We put it out, and they didn't buy it.
I did.
Yeah. Oh, good. Excellent. Most people did not. And it was very frustrating because I'm going, you know, what the hell, guys? You said you wanted to see it. We put it out. You didn't show up. And, you know, I consider that to be a little bit discouraging. On the other hand, I have people encouraging me to actually put out a chronologically accurate But I Digress collection. You know, literally just collect all of the strips, all of the columns in sequence. I don't know if I should do that or not. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I don't really know if it needs to be reprinted. I mean, does anyone really give a damn about what I thought about a movie from 20 years ago?
Actually,
but
yeah.
You never know.
I was recently rereading the first one. I personally really loved the introductions and the little editor's notes that update, you know, and now it's dated, but update to the printing time of what has come about since then. I thought that was just fascinating look into how things had changed, but maybe I'm unique in that. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. I suppose I could do a chronological thing. I mean, it's something that I'll discuss with my people and see if anyone wants to put that together.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. This interview originally aired on a Lost in the Static episode, so the Radiodrome fans are still going to be interested in it, but they may not have heard it. So I hope you guys check out Peter David's website, peterdavid.net, as well as Peter David's work in comics, film, movies, and prose. So, thank you, Mr. David, for the interview. It was amazing to talk to you.
1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.